This is Theatre Voice. I'm Dominic Cavendish, and I'm very pleased to be sitting opposite David Glass, a man who, it's fair to say, is a great theatre pioneer in this country and across the globe. David Glass is returning to the UK with a tour of a new show called Disembodied, which kicks off at the Battersea Arts Centre on the 23rd of February, running there till the 13th of March. A huge collision of things are happening around this one show,
yes.
David Glass. It's their first performance as an actor, artist for 8 years.
Yeah.
It's celebrating 25 years in theatre per se, and 15 years of your work as the David Glass Ensemble, which has been working across 40 countries and has apparently created over 1,000 new pieces of theatre in its time.
It's a bit of an amalgamation
of facts.
Workshops and all sorts of, that's right.
Yes, but could we start? It's obviously a time for retrospection as much as anything, as well as looking ahead. And there's another fact we will have to come to very soon, which is the establishment of the Lost Child Project as a non-governmental organisation. But if we could start very simply with Disembodied, could you say a little bit about that? What's it about, and why are you appearing in it?
Disembodied really grew out of an old relationship, friendship with Tom Morris, and he was departing Battersea Arts Centre. He was going to disembody himself from Battersea and move to the National Theatre at that point. And he got in touch with me to ask if I'd like to do, for the last, I think it's his last Oktoberfest, a performance of something, a piece, but a new piece, perhaps a scratch. And I kind of turned him diligently down a couple of times because I was so busy with The Lost Child or with ensemble work, and was away a lot of the time. And then finally, I just said, okay, well, I'll do it. All right. And we started, and Tom wasn't there for the first 2 weeks. It was me, myself, and I decided to work with Jonathan Cooper, who's a composer I've worked with for 8 years now. He's from very early Gormenghast days. He wasn't a composer on that, but an MD. And I said, do you want to play? So we played for 2 weeks in his flat, and most of it started with a voice, a kind of disembodied voice. And I had the title, which I wanted to do a piece which was about the idea of disembodiment, but not in any kind of conceptual way, even just beginning with the notion of it, and it was really began from there. That's all it was. And we played, and we created a lot of little fragments, little splinters, and what it was clear right from the early point was there was no center to it, but lots of fragments that are about the edges of things. And I think it connects a little bit to a show which I did, the last show I did, which was called Lucky, which was about autism. When I was young, psychologists thought maybe I was autistic, and when I was about five, they sent me to this doctor and stuff, and they tested me. And I think, like a lot of children, there is a level of autism in all children, apparently. And I have always been more interested in the edges of objects and people than necessarily the center of objects and people sometimes. So I'll often look, I had a great confusion about the edge of people and where so-called negative and positive space met. And this piece Disembodied was very much like that. It was always looking at things which you could never quite see at the front of your eye, but at the periphery of your eye, like touching mercury. And so by working on these fragments, we always didn't try to go at them straight on. We go from an edge in, and often the improvisation itself would not be the thing we use, but to one side of the improvisation, a moment when we stopped, or this kind of thing. So that's really what began, I think.
So is it in some ways autobiographical? I mean, I don't know if that's...
I think it's increasingly... I mean, it's still... For me, this piece is very much a piece that's been in process, and it's changed a lot. It's in its most formal version of it now, and it's taken a year and a half to make. But now that I perform it, I recognise some quite strong autobiographical material that sits inside it, which I was never conscious of. And in a way, maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. I didn't want to be conscious of it, and now I am more so. There's a piece in it. My mum came to see it the other day, and our family came from Switzerland originally, my mum's side, and my great-grandfather was a clarinetist in the Berlin Philharmonic. There's a bit in the show where a hand comes through a wall and removes a clarinet and takes it apart and buries it. I didn't really think about it, but she reminded me that my great-grandfather, who was a very good clarinet player, was basically taken by the Russians during the First World War. And he was meant to kill this boy in this village, and he didn't. They shot him through the hand, and he couldn't play his clarinet anymore, but he carried it home. and he basically walked whatever it was 800 miles back into Germany, and there he'd aged so much in the process, he slept in the barn and he died that night. His wife didn't recognise him, so he died in the barn. And my mum said, oh, that's a story of Opa, you know, my great-grandfather. And I didn't really think about it until really she said that.
That's extraordinary.
So
yeah.
You know, there's these sort of resonances in it.
Mm. I mean, was it always going to be the case that you would take the stage on this,
No, I think I there was no point that we were going to go, okay, let's explore the material and then give it to another actor. Mm. I think it was always about coming back to the stage, and so that's how it's felt. But it was never necessarily going to become, you know, a piece that was going to tour or even have a substantial run. It was a scratch, and if it didn't work out.
Mm.
But even from the beginning, people seem to connect quite well with it. And I think what's interesting is that it's not... one of the struggles, and I think Tom would absolutely, if he was here, would completely admit this, is Tom's tendency is about making narrative sense of things. My tendency, I suppose, is I like the non-literal, I like the metaphoric, the power of that. And I think they can often come to the same place sometimes, but... I think what works about this is that people come to it and they really take back whatever they have, but in a good way, powerful way. They seem to enjoy it in their own sense of what it means.
Mm. Why on a very sort of simple, pragmatic level, have you not been on the stage for 8 years? I mean, has it been that your other work has been really too absorbing, or have you not been that enthusiastic about appearing on stage?
I think a few things. I think one of them is that when we did La Dolce Vita in 1996, it was received very badly. I mean, I don't mean to speak about critics. The audience seemed to enjoy it a lot, but it was a real breaking point for the ensemble at that point. We've been doing a lot of middle-scale shows, and I became very disheartened, I think. Mm. I think the theatre was becoming increasingly commoditised, homogenised, corporate, and I couldn't fit in that. I tried with a musical and I didn't fit in. Forget about the merits of the show. I became very disillusioned with theatre in this country. And I really felt, having worked here for quite some time, I really had no home anymore here. So part of me said, and part of that was I really had nothing to say either as a director or as a performer anymore. I knew at that point I needed to get some renewal and to go away from it. It's often the way that you have to walk away for a while.
Mm.
So that was, I think that was the thing. I didn't have anything to say as a performer either. For good or bad, I'm not invited to perform in this country in other people's companies. Very rarely people like Mike Alfreds have staffed me, but it's mainly been foreign, Nina Gower, people like that, or Yuri Liebmoff. I think they like the physicality that a performer like me can bring, but in this country I don't sit easily. Again, that's fine, but I felt really I didn't have a place on stage here. There was no space for me. So that's part of the reason, but I just had nothing to say. I had nothing particularly wanted to say. Having done so much solo work for so many years in so many countries, I had nothing to say, and so I think it took me to get into my middle age before I wanted to go back on.
Mm. But out of that period of the, what we'll call it, an exile, almost maybe self-imposed exile, you decided to leave the UK.
Yeah.
Since that time, it's a long way ahead in a way, but you set up Lost Child, outfits in Cambodia, Vietnam. You've created almost a new species of theatre work, which is involved with finding marginalised, dispossessed children and creating work with them. Yeah. Could you talk to people? I mean, some people may be very up to speed about that, but others may not. Could you explain almost what happened then in the eight intervening years and what that project really means?
Well, the company carried on, and what I decided to do was I decided to go back to. I'd always travelled enormous amounts, and I'd always been very interested in and very saddened by the increasing numbers of street kids that are appearing all over the world, and they are increasing. It's not getting less, and I always felt again that the margins is the place to be. That's where change is happening. You'll never ever find change in this centre of things, because there's every reason not to change. In fact, it's comfortable, it's safe. At the edges, you'll find those people who are learning most and fastest, and the very edges you'll find kids always. And that idea fascinated me. And I always had, whenever I've been in countries like Brazil or Colombia, I'd always had good relationships with street kids. I'd always spent time with them. And so I wanted to focus on it. There was something about the palette of their emotions and sensibility which I found really, really interesting, and beautiful, their gesture. And so I focused on it by actually doing a journey. I went to Ireland and then to Peru, Mexico, New York, Cambodia, Philippines, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and spent 6 months really with street kids as much as possible in their environment, in their context. And out of it grew a project which might return me back to theatre, not consciously, but it began to appear, which was the Lost Child Trilogy. And the idea of that, the process of that bit, would be that we would have a company for 3 years, something that I'd want to do for a long time, and that company would make a piece, the first part, Hansel Gretel Machine, which was from looking at the child's perspective about the idea of abandonment, being abandoned or being lost. And then we would play that show in many parts of the world. And when we played it, we would work with street kids who would see the show, or they could be also, we worked with kids who were deaf or blind or whatever. And then they would make their piece, their version of Hansel Gretel. And then after that, we'd make a second piece based on the experiences we'd had with the kids. But we'd never, not their stories, but the feelings we had from them, the images we had when we were with them. Mm. And that became the second part of The Lost Child, called The Lost Child. And that took Gretel up to her adulthood, and she now herself is about to have a child, and it's really how she reflects on her own loss. But it was that was based on Through the Looking Glass, very, very roughly. It's a reflection piece. And the third part was a requiem that Jonathan wrote, which was for a children's choir, which was sung over the two pieces being played together, and it was reworked a little, and that was a trilogy. So making a piece and discovering a way of working with these kids became the same thing, in a way. We had to ask questions of how can we work with them, what can we do, where is there a circle that we can join, where's a space. And that 3-year experiment has grown into the second part of The Lost Child for now, which is the became the Lost Child Project, where we actually don't make theatre ourselves. We facilitate young people in quite a number of countries now, 21, 22 countries, to express their ideas, their images, their dances, their music, and their voices. And that's now led to the third part of this project, nearly 10 years on, 8 years on, which is establishment of that and that practice as an international NGO. So it becomes, from an arts organisation, becomes an international development organisation.
That's kind of interesting area of terminology, I suppose, isn't it? I mean, is it much more akin to a charity than a theatre enterprise?
Well, it's interesting because the legality of most theatre companies, certainly who get franchise funding, is that they are actually educational charities. Mm. However, my experience, I've got a fair amount of experience in development now, is that development works in very specific ways. And the way an arts organisation works is very different. To make something which I believe in passionately, which is that, you know, if you take the list of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, participation sits down quite low. I mean, it's important, but it sits quite low. And what I believe is quite the opposite. The only real right we have is the right to relationship in the world, participate. From that, the right to health, the right to love, the right to these things will then naturally appear. Physically, we have the right to participate. And I felt that creativity, be it art, painting, drawing, dancing, singing, is participation and play and learning and healing in its very nature. So any participation development organization should have creativity at its heart, and that was what I believed from my experience. So what we had to do is really take this creative notion of which sits at the heart of our methodology, which is about relationship building, and begin to find an alignment with which development practice. And development practice says fundamentally that you cannot just give people aid, you have to actually support them in growing and learning to create better society. And so these two things we're bringing together in the new charity. So legally it will be a charity, a separate charity as well. Mm. But I think your question is really about how these methodologies sit together, development and arts.
Mm. And what level, I mean, it sounds like a huge amount of groundwork has to be done in each of the countries concerned for those relationships to be to be fostered.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you encountered scepticism, resistance to this, what seems in a way a very obvious and almost innocuous principle that, that participation, as you say, is a fundamental right and necessity for a child and their relationship with
process.
The world?
Of course you get resistance. I mean, take a country like Vietnam, where we now actually have an office based there full time. We had to engage with a political situation there, where you know that if you want to make some sort of enter into some sort of change in your society, you have to do it through the party. You know, right or wrong, that's how you do it. And kids' involvement in that has to be very controlled and very specific. So what we've had to do is partner with the ministries of culture and education and social welfare to recognise that maybe creating, for instance, a forum theatre around about with peer-to-peer education, a theatre company that uses the stories of other kids about sexual awareness, about reproductive health and reproductive rights. Now this stuff was not talked about 5 years ago in Vietnam, but now we have helped establish a company which goes around and every 3 or 4 months performs to about 20,000 other kids using their stories. At first there was resistance there, and now there's much more acceptance, but you have to do it through a egalitarian approach, which is to share the notion of it, you know. But even here, I mean, working with kids here, people often say, well, we don't have time for them to do arts, they have to do all their subjects, and you might get them for 10 minutes or an hour or something, and you go, well, that's not enough for a workshop in drama. And so of course there's resistance everywhere. I'm a great believer in struggle. I think people think that things should be easy, and they're actually not. Life is about struggling, and creativity has struggle in it. It's just how much struggle, I think, you know.
Mm. And I suppose there are lots of other, you know, lots of simple questions that arise from that, and which is that some of the areas you have gone into, almost by definition, are areas, societies in high stress. You know, there might be post-conflict
trauma,
or even.
I
believe that in Indonesia, one of your teams had to withdraw because
beheadings
conflict
going on.
Yeah, it? Yeah. I mean, is it something that's uncover? I mean, through this enabling process of theatre, are you uncovering
trauma?
Trauma, and is the process akin to I don't know what you would call it, creative therapy? Is it a way of them actually confronting the things that are experienced?
Well, our approach is communal, and it works on circles and groups of kids together. And adults together. It's about flattening that then into a circle, and we explore our inner world images and the group's inner world and images. And I think what's really, really important here is that we're not therapists with it, but however it is therapeutic, just like going to the theatre always has been. It's therapeutic whether you watch it or whether you do it. You feel better if it's a good play. You go, that's just like my problem I have with my father. If you go to see, Death of a Salesman, it's therapeutic. But it's not. You don't have to have years and years of going to a therapist for that. Similarly, if anybody's ever done drama and you have to role play, or if you have to explore different emotions, you go, this is great. You come away enlivened by it. And kids, that's what play is. That's where it grows. It's a way of safely exploring painful and difficult things. But we are very careful. For instance, we've been asked to go and do some work in Sri Lanka now. With tsunami orphans, and one of the things we've stipulated is that we work with a child psychologist who would come with us, and you know, you can guess it, that for the most part kids are very resilient, they have trauma, the quicker they begin to get things out a bit, play a bit, take back a sense of play in their life, the healthier it'll be. If they leave it for 20 years, it'll probably end up being as neurotic as us about these things. But then there is the one or two kids who really have seen some very, very terrible things to see. There was kids in Indonesia. It was one kid who we worked with, and my wife, who was a facilitator, was wonderful with him. But he had seen his parents machete to death. He watched them for 2 hours as they were cut to pieces and dying. And that kid really couldn't be in the workshop. We had to remove him to be with a psychologist because it wouldn't have been fair on the other kids or on him. And so we're very careful in these situations to make sure we watch the body language, and also we work with the carers, the partners that are working with them as well. So it's not black and white, but for the most part, we all know kids hurt their knees and they get up and walk again. You know, that's what kids are good at.
Would you describe the style? I mean, because the Lost Child trilogy, as was seen in London, in effect, was clearly almost a small showcase of what had actually gone on. Across those different countries. Did it feel to you that you were creating a new kind of style? Was it something that you'd, I don't know, were you conscious of it, of there being an Englishness or a Eurocentricity about the kind of theatre that you were making overseas, on the other side of the globe? Or were you trying to create a new form?
It's interesting. It's a really good question. No one's ever really asked that question before, and I think it's a really good one. I think in retrospect, I look back now, and this was a learning. I've always been interested in what theatre could be rather than what it should be. And this was a period for me of renewal and learning. I can see that now. It's brought me back to theatre, and the kids helped transform me as well. But I didn't at the time go, all I did was go, I'm going to let go of pretty much everything I kind of know about theatre. I mean, I know reasonable about it, I've trained a lot and so on, but I'm going to try to start again, just begin again. It's always a nice thing to do. And I think, for instance, an example of that is that when we were in Colombia, I was working with one of the founders of the street kid movement, Padre Nicolás, with some of his kids. And he talked about how when he first arrived in the 60s, he'd find kids and they were always dying, and he didn't know how to bury them, because no one would bury them. So he found plastic to bury them. It was the cheapest thing, and it would just keep the smells in, blah, blah, blah. And we talked about this, but then I saw kids all over the world use plastic, and then I realised that plastic is the material of it's made out of oil. It exists because of oil, and many of the troubles that we have because of the reason why street kids exist is because of globalisation, particularly because of the oil industry. It's broken. We you know, oil companies will break down boundaries, will go in and change environments so much so that people are sort of moving across the globe. You know, across their countries, and street children is one of the byproducts, I say, of the petroleum industry. It really is, and so is plastic. And it's very interesting that metaphorically, in a way, these two things have come together. Children use plastic to live shelter under, and in the end, they'll often bury each other with. Mm. And so, plastic became a really important material in the show.
Yeah.
It became very important there's a language we use with plastic in the theatre. Then I realised that what I was exploring was a material object as metaphor. And that has become more relevant in the work of late. And in Disembodied, there's a lot of exploration of that, in a way. The way that an object can exist in a mental space, an emotional space in our lives. If your mother or father died holding a book, even if it was a book they weren't even interested in, it becomes very important to you. So I think that there was a language that was developing there that now I'm becoming more aware of. Yeah, No, absolutely.
You talked before about the kind of commodification of theatre, and it feels as though in some ways modern day, even fringe theatre, what one calls fringe theatre these days, has become quite removed from the radical fire from which it sprang. And do you think that the theatre of, in an age clearly which is under pressure from globalisation, that theatre has a should be taking a greater step forward in presenting protest, political protest, even that kind of work. I mean, because your work isn't overtly political, is it? But clearly, all the context in which it is created is by its own nature transformative and political.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I was in the community arts movement in the 70s, and I was lucky to spend time with Ed Berman, people like this, Augusto Boal. I knew them in the 70s, so I think my politicisation was one about it was a sensibility and aesthetic. I was never a great one for making agitprop theatre. I respect it, but it's not my thing, you know. I think what concerns me now, what's really important, is if you look at this whole problem that we have of first world, third world, or developing world, of corporateness, commoditization, it is a whole, and theatre is part of that. One of my great worries is that we are seeing what I would call the rise of corporate theatre, which are in the future, and I don't think, maybe I'm being a bit conspiratorial, but there will be 10 big companies who will run theatre worldwide, I have no doubt, in the next 10-15 years. We see it already. Not different from, say, AOL or whatever, these companies that run huge numbers of the media. And whilst, of course, there'll be lots and lots of other little companies around, what you will see is the dominance of this in the marketplace and the marketing of this stuff. The very fact that Disembodied, we are finding it very hard to get an audience at the moment. I mean, hopefully it'll sell. But we don't have, we can afford one £500 bit of marketing and time out. And the predominance of the power of these things means also these big organizations can take the best from any culture they wish. Theatre is becoming more and more multicultural, and they can say, we want you to come to Las Vegas, say, or we want you to come here and be in our company. Now, you might be in Cambodia. I work with a national theatre there. Now, National Theatre of Cambodia was decimated. There was only 20 of them left when I went there in 97, you remove two of those and that ecology suddenly becomes very, very unsafe, just as making families move to go and work for Nike somewhere. And so it's all part of a much bigger thing, a much bigger sickness that we have to really confront. And I believe that many of the values that theatre has begun to embrace, you will see how they rose up in the 80s. When I first started, you'd see 20 actors on stage and maybe one of them would manage it all a bit in their part time. Now what you see is theatres full of managers and two people on stage. So the rise of the management culture within theatre has become the major culture. And you go to the theatre, what you're usually doing is actually being a bean. The people doing it, the people seeing it, so it's the bean being counted. Not a qualitative relationship. And I think that's what's missing. Same when you go to Sainsbury's, you buy an apple, and it's not about meeting the person who maybe grew it, or even as sold it, who knows the person who grew it. It's completely separated. So the relationships have been broken up, and a theatre is all part of that same thing. We can't imagine we'd separate ourselves from that. And I would agree with you. I mean, you're saying something quite strong, and I agree with you, is that Fringe has completely embraced, so-called Fringe, has embraced values of product, success, and the need to homogenize and package yourself. So you'll see a lot of recent companies who have actually branded themselves in a certain way, and that's how they're selling it. So you go to see a certain kind of company, you go, yeah, got it, yeah, got the brand, good. And this, to me, is an anathema to the very nature of what theatre is, which is a moment of transformation. In every second it could change, you know, and it can't be branded, in fact.
Do you so in some ways you're possibly in for another bout of disillusion, in the sense that coming back to the theatre, I don't know whether you've changed your, so much has happened that your priorities have shifted anyway, but yeah, I mean the climate hasn't particularly changed since the New Labour came to power, has it really? I mean, there's been more funding, but I don't think some of the differences that you've noticed creeping into British theatre haven't, you know, they're not going to go away, are they?
Well, I think it's a bit, if you imagine the arts and creativity as a playground, which I believe it is, it's a playground. A playground is a place where you play games and tell stories safely. Well, what's happened is the contractors have come in to take over the playground and turn it into a car park. But if I have anything to say about it, anything to do with that, in my little tiny way, I mean, I used to be on the Arts Council panel in the 80s, and I've been on a number of organisations, and then within my own company, I will hold back as much of that in my own little bit of the playground as possible. And I think the very fact that you can wave a flag and say, this bit you will not step on, you will not terrorise or press this bit, is just like what we say to the kids, the street kids, is, you know, you can only take so much oppression. At some point you have to say enough, you will not do this. Because in fact, as soon as you do that, the bullies and the people who appear to have power suddenly vanish. And what you often get is a new level of humanity. I think Gandhi said it very, very much better than I could ever say it. And he said that first people will ignore you, and then they will fight you, they will laugh at you, and then they will fight you, and then you'll win. And I think there are tiny groups, many, many group network groups, grassroots groups in development, in arts, in business, going, enough with this greed, enough with this, you know, and we will not accept it. And I think that's what I take courage in. And I think in theatre we have to do the same. But there aren't enough people saying that, you know.
But you're quite optimistic, really, that, or rather in some ways you still carry forward some of the optimism of your generation and the generation that preceded you in the theatre, the early theatre movements of the alternative theatre. The theatre can change the world almost. I mean, that's crass. Summation, but I mean, it is a feeling that one gets from looking at the body of your work, that there is that belief there. Is that fair to say that you?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's not so much theatre can change the world, but theatre is a way of changing the world. It's not everyone does it all over the world, whether it's a community or whether it's professionalised, and it's done in order to imagine a world that we haven't got yet. That's why it's a could thing, not a should, and that's why we play in the playground as kids. Is to make a world that we haven't tasted yet safely, and as soon as that disappears, it's a little bit like another area of this is the idea of metaphor. Is if you actually look carefully at what young people are seeing as metaphor these days, hours and hours and hours of it are on TV watching these 3 minutes, or no, sorry, even 30 second segments of amazing fantasy, but at the end of it what they see is, buy the fucking car, stupid. All metaphor is reduced to this. All this madness, fantasy, is equal to buy this. And that's the complete opposite of what a metaphor is. A metaphor means that what Hamlet means to you and what it means to me are two separate things, especially in a world where we're so different and yet close to each other. We see Hamlet and we'll see different things. And that's the beauty of metaphoric thinking. It allows for flexible, holistic thinking.
We've hardly scraped the surface, really, of all the work you've done in the last 3 decades, but we have to end it there. But thank you very much, David Glass.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.